On this week's show, the guys talk about The Mandalorian's return for season 2, One Night in Miami's chances at the Oscars, and we have an incredible guest, Vince Vaughn.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 142 of Real Blend, a podcast that is dedicated to the memory of the late, great Sean Connery. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, and I want to explain why I'm channeling my inner Tony Montana today. Just something cool for the people who are watching on the YouTube channels. Cinema Blend got this great opportunity through a company called Shoe Palace, and they have this really cool Scarface 2020 line of clothing that's coming out, and they sent me the Tony Montana shirt. So it's funny because I wore it today and thought it'd be part of the show, and nobody said anything to me at all. They just thought it was a fashion choice.
You popped up, and yeah. I honestly I saw the shirt.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting.
Rolled with it.
But it has a tiger on it. Yeah, I wasn't going to call it.
I went through like kind of a moral crisis in my head because I thought about saying something about your shirt.
Yeah.
But then in my head, I just thought like, don't be a dick.
Maybe he likes it.
Don't like make fun of it. Though I got to be honest, you in that shirt,
yes.
I feel like it's not complete unless there's no undershirt.
Right? I know. I feel
like let the chest hair out a little bit.
I'll tell you a little something about me. Not a single chest hair on me. I just
started getting
bald
chest hair.
As a baby's bottom. Congratulations,
smooth
Kev.
From the eyebrows down.
I just started getting chest hair. I'm like really excited. I'm 36, man.
We are already
late
revealing
bloomer.
Far too much about the Real Blend team. I got to point out that, of course, that's the Shoe Palace shirt. Not a sponsor of the show, but they did give us an exclusive look over on Cinema Blend. So go over to the main site and check that out. Let's get into this week's show. We're going to talk about One Night in Miami, Regina King's amazing film, and how it's deciding to enter into the awards race. The Mandalorian is back, and we're going to talk about episode 1 of season 2, because we caught up with that. So if you haven't yet seen the episode, catch up with it before you get to later on in the show. And we have, a tremendous guest on behalf of the horror comedy freaky Vince Vaughn is joining Real Blend. And God, he was an excellent fit on the show, plugged in beautifully with the hosts. And by hosts, I, of course, mean Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev. How are you?
Hello, Sean. Jake, Gabe. Good to have you back, Gabe, by the way.
And
glad to be back.
Gabe is back as well, too. Yes. And joining the show as well, too, Jake Hamilton joining the show. Co-hosting the show, Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Jake, how are you?
You know what, buddy? How are you?
I'm doing okay. Let's get through some housekeeping notes before we throw it into the Vince Vaughn episode. I want to let people know that if you're watching us on YouTube and appreciating my Tony Montana shirt, thank you very much. Make sure that you hit subscribe, turn on your notifications, and keep up to date with the episodes that we put on the YouTube channel. If you're listening to us where you get your audio podcast needs served, you can go to the description down below and figure out how to join us on YouTube, and especially to let you guys know why the YouTube channel is a little bit more valuable than you might think. Last week, the Michael Giacchino interview, we did the audio for it, which was the bulk of the interview. And then towards the end of the conversation we were having with him, he decided to turn it into a show and tell and pull out all these amazing props from behind him because his office was incredible. And first off, you should have just watched the interview with Michael Giacchino because his office was really cool. But then when he started to pull out all these really great movie related props like Stormtrooper helmets and a Doctor Strange amulet, which we now know thanks to Scott Derrickson is not the Doctor Strange amulet. Felt a little bit bad about that.
Give the story on that real fast so people know.
We never said it's not one of the. He just wondered.
No. So here's what happened. I might have overstepped a little bit. So Giacchino showed us an amulet from Doctor Strange, one of the ones that Doctor Strange wears. It has the time stone inside of it, the Eye of Agamotto, as nerds like myself would like to call it. And we freaked out because we thought it was one of the official ones from the set. And so when I tweeted the photo, the screen grab of it, I said he's showing us one of the ones that he took home from the set of Doctor Strange, making an assumption that it was one of the ones from the set of the movie. Now, that prompted Scott Derrickson to weigh in underneath it and say, oh, that's where that was. There were only three of these made, and I have one, Scott Derrickson says. And then he says, apparently you have one, Michael. And the other one went to a producer. And then Giacchino said, now, guys, I didn't say where I got this from. Everything else I showed you was official, which included a statue from Lost, which
right.
had
in John's defense, heroine. He was yeah. showing us official things. Like it was in the midst of like a piece of music used from Planet of the Apes or yeah. the prop from Lost. So it was just deduced that it was. Sure. Yeah.
I leave for 1 week. And you guys start pissing
now, Gabe,
off giant
Gabe,
Marvel
you
directors.
Heard the interview out of context. Did you believe that he was showing us the true Eye of Agamotto?
Well, no, I listened to it after.
Okay.
I saw the context on Twitter. So it was great.
By the way,
We made a conscious choice not to include the show and tell in the audio portion of the podcast, audio only, just because it kind of misses something if you can't. Yeah. But there was in the rewatch, because I was like, what would this be like if I were listening to it? There was one moment when he got up to go to his shelf to like gather some things. And you could just hear the three of us whispering, like, what do you think he's going to get?
Just like, guys, what is happening right now?
And I thought that would have been funny if we'd have been able to hear just the audio portion of that.
Did we ever tell the audience that he was live from Middle Earth? He was in the middle of a Hobbit.
You don't get to talk about Middle Earth, Sean.
Yeah. Well, you can't purchase a Doctor Strange amulet, or you cannot purchase a Scarface shirt, but you can get great Real Blend merchandise by going to our store, cinemablend.com/shop. Pick up some new Real Blend merch. And anyway, on with the show. Weekly poll. We asked you guys last week if the future of Star Wars storytelling, Jake, I'm going to throw this to you, and Daenerys, is the future of Star Wars storytelling going to be in theaters, on television, or somewhere else? Star Wars storytelling.
Okay, here's the deal, is that you asked that question
yes.
the weekend that The Mandalorian returned.
Well, yes, I did.
Which, so, like, I would say that it's safe to say that no matter what, no matter how you really feel one way or the other, that, and not just the return, but a hell of a return that got people very excited, that the answer is going to skew very heavily for television.
Well, you're correct. Television had 61%. Of the votes, and in theaters 28.7, somewhere else had 10.2. And I think it's fair to say that the things that Star Wars is doing moving forward, which is just basically The Mandalorian and then the Obi-Wan show, is more exciting primarily because we don't really know what is coming on the film side, right? Like, it's a lot of potential, yeah. but nothing that's been developed. Taika Waititi apparently is developing a show, a movie. Rian Johnson is theoretically doing a
Sean,
trilogy of films.
At what point are Star Wars and Marvel going to combine and just do like Obi-Wan Division or something like that? Like, they could totally, like, I'm being serious. I can remember those like video games, like DC Comics versus Marvel.
Yeah,
like, you could. I mean, Disney owns Marvel and Star Wars.
And
could you ever
see? There's a popular line of Star Wars comic books as well, too. So there's things that you can
do.
Yes.
Keep in mind that Star Wars takes place in the past.
Yes.
Like, it happened a long time ago. So
do we actually know the year Star Wars takes place?
1973.
Well, no, 77 is the first movie. Do we know the year it takes place for real? Do we know that?
No.
I don't think
so. Just a long time ago.
Okay.
You know what? I hope a lot of people ask George Lucas that question, though.
What year did this take place?
What year, honestly, did this all
take
place?
Like the 40s?
Actually, I've never thought about that. What do you think theoretically, Jake, as a Star Wars fan, what do you think's happening on Earth during that time period? If just in a, I know it's fictional, but what do you think is going on in human life?
I think it's all before humans exist.
Dinosaur era? You think it's dinosaur time?
I think it's a long time ago.
Dinosaur time.
They
almost called Jurassic Park that.
It's the Cretaceous period, whatever you want to call it.
Too late. You already called it dinosaur.
Come on, I'm sorry.
But it is odd, like that. I always found that strange about Star Wars because I would automatically assume that it's like way, way in the future because of the technological advances that have been happening.
That's what's cool
and
about
we
it.
Have ships. No, it's not cool. It's almost like they didn't think it all the way through. Like he thought it sounded fair,
like
though,
a new trilogy. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. To be fair, though, a long time ago is pretty relative because right now, 6 months ago feels like a long time.
Gabe, last night feels like a long time.
Theoretically, Star Wars could be so far in the future that a long time ago is now.
That was good.
Chris Nolan style.
Wasn't Battlestar Galactica, like that was Battlestar Galactica, right? Battlestar Galactica.
You know who you guys should ask about this?
George Lucas?
Harrison Ford.
Oh, yeah.
Harrison Ford would 100% have the answer to this question.
Oh, my God. Could you imagine if you sat down across from him in a junket and said, now, I just want to run a theory past you. What if... A long, long time ago is because you're so far in the future
that it's now.
What? What would be worse? Him just straight up punching you in the face or him just staring at you in silence?
Didn't he call it kryptonite in your interview?
Yeah, it was carbonite and he called it kryptonite. And then I corrected him and he goes, I just work here.
I'll say one of the only sad things that has come out of this job is realizing that we care more about these movies than the actors do. I just find it so insane that we are so in tune with movies and then the people who are in them just don't really care.
But in the actor's defense, like we have people out there that are very active on social media about Real Blend. And I'm not saying that they care more about it than we do, but there are some moments where I think like, Jesus, like they do more for the show than I do, and I'm a co-host for it. Sometimes it's not so much that you don't. Sometimes there are just people that just are really passionate about stuff, and that's great.
I also can't imagine having to talk about the same movie that you made 40 years later.
Imagine doing a junket interview. 10 years ago that people keep asking you about.
But I will say this, Jake and I did the Halloween junket. That movie came out decades ago. And I thought Jamie Lee Curtis answered every question, whether it was a question she's gotten a million times, as if it was the first time she ever answered.
Yeah, but I think it's because she was promoting Halloween. I think if you were to ask her about Halloween at the Knives Out junket, she'd be like, what the hell? Like, in the same way when you got Harrison Ford at Force Awakens. Like, of course he was great about talking about Star Wars. He was there to promote Star Wars.
Yeah,
kills me. You guys got Willis for that Die Hard thingamabob too. It's like the only time I could ever talk to him about it. He's such a prickly son of a gun now. All right. Anyway, let's get to this week's interview. The great Vince Vaughn.
I can't take you seriously wearing that shirt.
It's got tigers on it. Join the show.
Wait, hey, Sean, behind you. Do you mind saying hello to your little friend?
No, I'm being serious.
There's a little friend behind you.
Green Lantern?
Baby Yoda, yeah.
Baby Yoda's out there as well, too. Vince Vaughn joined the show to talk about Freaky, and while we had him, we discussed a number of other things, including 25 years of Swingers, his idea, or at least the idea that's being shared around for the Wedding Crashers 2, and a lot of other things from his career. So,
Lost World, dinosaur time!
Without further ado, it's Vince Vaughn on the Real Blend Podcast.
The Cretaceous, whatever, come on.
Vince, thank you so much for joining us on Real Blend. I'm going to jump right into it. I know you're in the middle of a junket. You and I spoke earlier, and I was talking to the guys earlier and making fun of myself for asking a really bad body swap question. I said, like, dude, everyone's asking a body swap question. I think I asked a bad one. When you do a movie like this, it has such a fun premise. Do you kind of prepare when you start to do press to get asked a different variation of that same question? And did you get any bad ones today?
No, I don't think they're bad ones. I think part of the fun of this type of movie is that concept. And what was unique was Chris Landon and Michael Kennedy, the writer, who was terrific. I was surprised, frankly, that I'd never seen it in a horror context before. So it just popped off the page as a really fun idea. And, you know, when these things are done well, they're a lot of fun. And so I really expected that to be a large part of what the concept is, you know, that's sort of the fun. And so much for me that the stuff I'm not in, where you see Millie sort of go through high school in a way where she's not always treated the best, there's an odd viewing experience where, you know, the butcher's terrible, but there is sort of a justified revenge that happens on occasion back at high school as well. So it was just unique in that way, and surprising that I hadn't seen something that took advantage of that before.
You know, Vince, I talk about this a lot, but I was bullied heavily in middle school and high school, so these themes stick out to me very much when I watch films like this. I'm simultaneously entertained, but at the same time, I'm also kind of like remembering aspects of school, but in a good way. But I never really stood up for myself. And there's a great moment where your character, well, she's inside your body, and she gets to stand up for herself against a bully in a bathroom. And I just was interested to know, just generally for you personally growing up, was bullying something that you dealt with? And or did you ever stand up for people who were bullied, and or have a moment where you stood up for yourself if you were bullied?
Yeah, there's nothing worse than bullying, you know, and hurting someone's spirit. It's a terrible way to try to have a moment of feeling safe. By really putting someone down and hurting them that way. And I wonder how much when you're younger, people are really aware of the trauma that they're causing or the hurt. And then, you know, of course, kids on the other side of it don't share with their parents because they don't want to be embarrassed or let them down. You know, there's just not a lot of, you know, at those times, good communication, understanding of it. And then as you get older, you realize, well, this bully's in a lot of pain probably. Like, you wouldn't think that, but they're learning it somewhere, or they just haven't been taught that there's consequences and one shouldn't do that. So I think it's a fertile ground for all of us as human beings. There's a stage where you're, you know, you're going through changes, you're not confident, your public humiliation is a big deal, and your universe is so small, there's no way to escape it because this is your ecosystem. So I think in the script, it does a good job of setting Millie up, both with complicated home life. She's got a good, nice, good quality of friends. But even the small thing of the guy wooing at her in the hallway, to him, it's just a moment in his day. But for her, it's like, you know, you're totally making her feel weak and yeah, unimportant. It's a horrible feeling. And that's what's interesting in the film, I think, that even though it's the butcher and dark, it's a weirdness that you're almost like with the teacher who was unkind. We've all had those moments. So it's sort of in an odd way addresses it. That's almost empowering in a dark kind of surprising way.
Our teachers didn't as the teacher in this movie, though.
No, right. One would suggest that maybe in their own way, anyone who chooses that path probably is limited in sort of connections and what they're dealing with.
Vince, I loved that this movie, Freaky, played very much like an homage to the 80s slasher films that we grew up on, especially early on in the movie. There's a moment where you're sort of stalking somebody around a mansion. You got Michael Myers vibes, Jason vibes. We were just recently talking on the show about memories of being in a video rental store and spending extra time in the horror section, scanning those VHS covers. They felt so off limits to us. It was R-rated, you know, we were really paying attention to how we rented that type of stuff. This brought me back to that. I'm curious if you had memories like that, or who introduced you to horror early on and got you into the genre.
What a great sense memory. I was just discussing this with friends, in that one of the things I loved about that video store experience was it gave you a chance to break out of your norm.
Yeah.
Because you felt private. Like, I almost remember as a kid going to a store where I didn't know the people, because it kind of gave me permission to look down aisles and stuff that for whatever reason I didn't feel as confident. Mm-hmm. And I think there was more of a chance as an individual to carve out your unique taste, because you got to walk by aisles and you would do stuff. One of my objections today with some of the way that we see stuff is, and these guys are good at it, like they're good at deciding what you're gonna like, but there's less of a chance to break out because it's just thrown right in your face and you're grabbing it. And there was something great about record stores and rental stores, that I could go down a path that was not common to me. And what a beautiful door to open and start to appreciate something different. For me, it was my sister, who was older than me. And she was so great in so many ways, my sister Valerie, and she really cracked the door to horror. I remember being wanting her approval and respecting her so much and wanting to watch them and kind of holding it together, but having such a wild imagination, being absolutely terrified, so much that I couldn't sleep, that I really had issues, but I would go back for more. The Evil Dead being the one that I remember freaking out the most because of the POV of the camera just terrified me. You know, the unseen demonic presence was terrifying. But I think that's the fun of movies. It's like in genre movies, it's like an amusement park. It's fun to go on all the different rides and take the appreciation of those genres. And Chris Landon, who's obviously a fan and terrific addict, I think was having a lot of fun, him and Michael Kennedy, with doing the very thing you suggested, which is, you know, tilting these iconic masks and images and creating that kind of, you know, standard understood avatar, only then to enjoy the body switch and kind of flip it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of, go ahead, Jake.
Oh, yeah. No. I was just thinking about the piggybacking on that idea of sort of this movie paying tribute to the great sort of 80s slasher movies. You know, I was thinking about Psycho, you being in the Gus Van Sant remake of Psycho, which in its own way, in a different way, pays tribute to a different kind of era of horror movies. And I'm sort of curious, both films obviously completely different with different intentions, but both pay tribute to my favorite horror movie genre. I'm sort of curious, how are those experiences for you as an actor different and how are they similar?
Well, Gus was really, to me, it was like, I always looked at the arts, you know, music and songs, like non-religious in that they were there to be explored. And Gus was making really interesting films at the time. So I was saying yes to him. I didn't really think through the process as much. And it was a really, as an actor, an interesting thing, because there was days where we would watch the scene and match it shot for shot. And then we would abandon that on other days. It wasn't consistent, but the exercise for me selfishly was just an interesting thing to go through. And where this was concerned, I think Chris is so talented at blending comedy and horror. It's a difficult thing to do. So we were putting so many things on its ear and having so much fun. But what I loved the most was that there's an emotional believability that goes throughout, like the scene with my mother or the scene with Uriah's character Booker or the friendships. Like, I think part of what helps us buy the body swap, and obviously Catherine's performance tremendously so as Millie is, I think we emotionally buy those feelings and connections. And that's part of the magic trick, I think, of buying this situation is the ability for all of us, like I said, to connect to those very vulnerable moments younger where you're over your head in water, you're not used to, or you're feeling, you know, picked on or isolated. And that's really what carries the day, I think, in a lot of this.
Yeah, I love the scene in the clothing store with the polo. That was a really great moment. You mentioned video stores. Growing up, one of the VHSs or the DVDs you'd walk by was Swingers. I mean, that iconic picture with you holding the martini. That's another version of it as well. But there's that famous one where you're holding the martini out, which is a really cool shot. That movie turns 25 years next year, which is absolutely incredible. And I just wanted to ask your retrospect on that film, what you remember about it now, 25 years later, and the idea of You're So Money becoming such a pop culture element thing as well. I was just curious to your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that was lines I used to say joking around with John. A lot of the lines that were in the movie, and then he sort of, you know, wrote the screenplay and took a lot of those things and put them in the film. And I think the one thing about it was I remember saying to him, you know, why are we auditioning for stuff that's not really about what's going on? Like, I love when I see people who are younger giving themselves permission to write movies or make movies, because you're sort of in a unique moment where you're a part of it. And so for us, it was really like, we really wanted to be uncompromising. And I think what made it unique for us was that we were kind of vulnerable. These were guys that were not, a lot of guys making movies were making movies like the guys were the super coolest or the toughest. And I think part of what makes Swingers work is there's an honesty and a vulnerability, like they're helping a friend through a breakup. Everyone has different ideas of what the right way is to meet people. Swingers captures that moment where you're either out of high school or out of college. you don't really share anything in common with the girl, or you like in class with her. How do I go up to someone that I don't know at all and be able to make an introduction and see if there's any chemistry there when they don't know who I am? So it's dealing with that very unique moment that happened to be specifically set in Los Angeles at a time where a lot of these punk bands were becoming these, you know, original swing bands, which was really fun and cool. But the moment I think is relatable no matter where you are or where you're from. You're sort of out of college or a group of friends, and you're kind of figuring out dating as an adult for the first time and moving away potentially from where you're from and dealing with heartbreak. So I think that the movie as a comedic version, but at the core, at the essence of it, I think, you know, you're not really inventing stuff. You're just kind of on revealing what's already there, which is the journey that John's character takes, which is, oh, you know, it's better to be myself and make a real connection with someone than to try to remember to be all these things that I'm not. And then maybe really not have someone get to know me. You know, it's sort of a lesson that we have to go through.
We love nostalgia. Vince, could we ever revisit those characters?
You know, the one thing we're talking about just recently, which I mentioned, is Wedding Crashers. David Dobkin had a really good idea that's contemporary. And, you know, I never went and made a sequel to a lot of these films at the time because it felt like we were just chasing a success. But what I like about where Crashers potentially could be at is there's something that's of this moment that feels really good. That's a good, you know, a lot of these comedies, like even something like Wedding Crashers, you're sort of investigating things that I think are real in our lives, but the comedy is an overcommitment to the absurd.
Yeah. I wanted to sort of ask you that question about sequels, because going over your filmography, you had so many that would have just been layups, you know, and horror produces a lot of them too. So Freaky could very easily do it, but I was curious why you avoided it. You said it just felt like because you were cashing in on something.
Yeah, it just didn't feel like the story idea for the second one was as good as the moment of the excitement that the movie did well.
Gotcha.
You know, I felt like I just go make another movie that was interesting versus go and tread on it. But I kind of think the timing for Crashers and what it discusses is contemporary and fun. And this could be a fun way in. But yeah, I always just felt like if there was a really good story and a continuation, like, you know, Dodgeball, I love that character and those guys, but you'd want to make sure that you're investigating something new. You're not just treading on something that was already kind of discussed, you know.
God, I admire that.
The
so
Isla Fisher table scene might be one of the funniest scenes I've ever seen in a movie. I would love to have seen that scene get shot, to be honest with you.
That scene and the breakup singing scene as well, is those are actually complicated because you have to turn the camera around. Everyone has to match energy for what's going on. So technically those scenes are challenging, but yeah, those circumstances, that was a lot of fun. That movie was a ton of fun to shoot. What a great cast. Everyone involved was really, really terrific.
All right, Jake, take us out, man.
Speaking of sequels, right now Universal is shooting a new Jurassic World movie, which brings back a lot of the original characters. I think, say, Jeff Goldblum, Sam Neill, and Laura Dern are all coming back. And I loved you in The Lost World. Obviously, it was great. Yeah. You got to work with Spielberg. And I'm sort of curious, was there ever any conversation of bringing your character back into any of the world films? Or is that even something that you would be open to revisiting sort of the dinosaur world again?
I like Steven quite a bit. I remember he saw Swingers, and that's when I talked to him, and I've worked with him since. And I really loved just how warm he was in talking about films. I'm a film nerd, so I've talked about Westerns and shots and scripts, and he's obviously a wealth of knowledge, but very generous with that. And as far as The Lost World was concerned, it was fun for me to go participate in something like that and be a part of it. But it wasn't necessarily for me my biggest calling or something that I was wanting to do over and over again. Not that I wouldn't be open to movies like that because I have fun going to see them. But as an actor, at that time, I was just more excited by like Wedding Crashers and, you know, Old School and those kind of things that were contemporary. But I could definitely go and see myself doing something with effects in movies like that were fun and had a good story, you know, obviously Jaws being one of the great ones in that genre as you discuss it. But no, there was no conversations. There was no conversations as far as the Lost World was concerned currently.
For sure.
Well, we really appreciate your time, Vince. And I'm glad you mentioned Westerns. I actually just watched Once Upon a Time in the West for the first time. They're Leone films. And I'm like really kind of going through like the older Westerns now. But listen, we really appreciate
Charles Bronson.
dude, I'm like, I am all in on Bronson. I just watched Great Escape. I just watched Dirty Dozen. I'm like all in on Bronson right now, man.
Another good one with Bronson.
Hard Times?
Yeah, he plays like a bare knuckle fighter, I believe.
Yeah, I did Death Wish. That was real. That Goldblum scene was brutal, man. Oof.
Yeah.
Man.
It's fun to discover movies, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's still something I haven't seen. And, you know, it's just so great to find these films and go watch them.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, Vince. We appreciate it, man.
Good to talk to you.
Appreciate it. We need to thank Universal for giving us Vince Vaughn on the Real Blend podcast. And Freaky is coming out later in November. We're going to have reviews for that as we get closer to the release.
November 13th. Yeah.
Is that the date?
Friday the 13th.
In theaters too, right?
Yeah, select theaters Friday the 13th, supposedly.
Good for them.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Are they doing a combo?
I don't think they are. No. I VOD? Think it's just going to theaters. Okay. I'm pretty sure it's just going to theaters.
But you know, like I get the saving it for Friday the 13th, but that movie would have been, no pun intended, it would have been killer for a VOD release in October.
Now,
like,
when
people were desperate for like horror movie content, I think it would have done so well.
That's a good point. Now, does this movie go under the new standards of Universal's 17-day thing?
Well, that's what I would think. That's interesting. Yes. I think so it theoretically probably would be.
2 weeks.
God, I keep forgetting that that's a thing because the world exists.
Yeah. Exactly.
So for people who don't know what I'm referring to, like earlier in the pandemic, there was a deal struck with AMC and Universal Pictures that they would shrink the window from the 90 days to the standard 90 theatrical before going to on-demand to, I think it was 17 days. So 17 the question now is, will Freaky and future Universal films have to follow that? Is that, I mean, that is confirmed, right? That deal is confirmed.
Yes, that deal is in place, and I would assume Freaky is one of the first ones to take advantage of it. Yes.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1 pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We were talking about the fact that eventually somebody was going to make a thriller, drama, something set during the pandemic, that there would be stories that would address the pandemic. We have had conversations with multiple people in the industry who are creative storytellers to talk to them about how the pandemic is going to affect the type of stories that they tell moving forward, with people telling us that they would want to stay as far away from it as possible and want to offer up stories that gave you alternatives to everything that we've been living through. And some other people who have decided that they're going to plunge fully into it and make it part of their storytelling. And that brings us to the trailer for a movie called Songbird. And I think we all had the same reaction. My reaction when I watched it was, and I kind of heard everybody's reaction before I pressed play on it, most people were reacting with just like, oh, it's too soon. This isn't the movie. I don't want to see this. And I was like, it can't be that bad. And then I played it and I was like, oh no, I really don't. I just don't want to see this. Like it not only is it too soon, it feels like it's using all of the aspects that have been super uncomfortable about the pandemic, being stuck in your house, not being able to communicate with loved ones, having to communicate through technology, and tries to manipulate them into a thriller, like almost like it looked like a home invasion type thriller. And then of course it doesn't help that, and Kevin, I know that this is your boy, but it says produced by Michael Bay. And if we're going to get a pandemic thriller that connects with the audience, it's probably going to be something a little more sophisticated, maybe reaches a little bit higher than what I saw from Songbird. But my gut reaction when I saw this trailer was just too soon. Well, I'm not ready to watch that.
One thing I found fascinating, though, at the start of the pandemic, and again, I don't think this is a good idea. I just say that right out. I don't think this is a good idea for a film right now, considering people are still dying from this virus. It's very serious. So, but at the beginning of the pandemic, what movies became popular? Contagion, all those. And my point being is that, like, do you think studio systems were looking at what people were consuming? And they were like, Contagion is the number one film that people are watching right now, whatever the metric on it was. Do you think that was the thought process? Because I can't think of any other logical reason to put out a movie like this now, especially maybe I could see it happening like years. Like it's, and again, it's always interesting when something, disastrous happens in the world and then we see a film based on it. And it's always a question of whether or not it was too soon, you know. And I think obviously now this is too soon. I just wonder the thinking, like did they not understand how the internet would respond to this?
I thought it felt rushed. It looks like it was shot in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It has a series of recognizable actors.
Yeah, pretty big actors.
Demi Moore,
yeah.
Alexandria Daddario, but they all look like that they shot their scenes like at their homes. And it was just, the footage was cobbled together. But, and the reason why I'll say the comparison I'm going to make is that Greenland movie that Gerard Butler made, which was made way before any of this happened. But because of the nature of its story, and this was a comet that was coming down to hit, or pieces of an asteroid that were coming down and about to hit our planet, that ended up making relevant commentary about, like, what would we do in a global disaster?
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't made with the intention of, we're going to comment on a global disaster. It just happened to be there. This movie feels like it was
like
rushed
Utopia,
into
Jake,
production.
Right?
Yeah, but even on the flip side of that, because we've gotten movies made in the pandemic that have pandemic themes already with Host, which is a movie I've obviously been being a massive fan of.
Mm-hmm.
But what I loved about that is that it's a horror movie, and it's not about COVID-19. It exists because of the circumstances that COVID-19 has yielded, which is a group of girls who are bored at home and on Zoom, like we literally are right now, and decide to have a seance.
Yep.
They even have a joke that, like, I don't even know if it'll play in 10 years, which is like one of them sneezes and the other girls go like, oh my God. Like, oh, you know, like that's, you know, like that's something that we can relate to now. I don't know how that's going to play.
Right.
So to me, that works like a circumstances, a circumstance that arises from the making it about the pandemic and then turning it up to 11.
Mm-hmm.
It feels icky. It feels like someone, the writer, whoever it is, watched the news for a week and found like the buzzwords and found like the things that's really setting people off,
mm-hmm.
and then decided to turn them all like, okay, it's that, but what if it were like what are people's fear? Like, I, you know, like we're at a point, you know, where a lot of people don't even want to turn on the news anymore because of the reality that's happening. So why would you want to take what's happening on the news and then imagine how much worse it could, like people's anxiety is not bad enough already. You want to show them exactly what would happen if things got worse.
Right.
Well, also to Jake's point, like there are shows that are coming out that are designed around it in a good way. Like Netflix is doing cool stuff with like social distancing ideas about like how to do dating and whatever their shows are, The Social Dilemma, whatever. I don't know the specifics of all those shows, but those are all falling into a field of how we're adapting to the time. Not like this movie that we're referring to is like taking it to this like disaster extreme. Because it's like, what is it, mutilated like 4 years later into the, I don't know the story specifically for it, but
I think it's in 2023 is what it's like, because they call it COVID
2024.
Read that Anne Hathaway is going to be in like a romantic comedy set during the pandemic?
Stop.
I thought I read that somewhere.
I remember there was like a romantic comedy shot for there was with one of the actors from Hamilton. There was like him and his girlfriend who lived together, or wife who lived together. They shot like a love series that took place during the pandemic. But again, to Jake's point about like the Host show movie, it's around how we have adapted versus creating a disaster movie that makes it much worse. So
did you ever see it, Kevin? Did you ever watch Host?
I have not seen it.
Oh, you gotta do it. I know we're out of horror movie top month now, but you gotta, Sean watched it. Turn off the lights. It's like 55 minutes. Oh, it's brilliant.
I want to see it. I don't have Shudder though.
It's super effective.
You can do a trial, like 10-day trial.
All right.
Now that's cheating. Why would you do that? You pay for
Didn't Netflix get rid of their trials?
Okay, Sean will pay for it.
Yes, I think they did. All right, let's move on to horror that we think is actually going to work, which is Scott Derrickson returning to the realm of, well, no, I'm not sure they ever did a Joe Hill adaptation, but Joe Hill's stories have been adapted before. Daniel Radcliffe did Horns, and there's another one that Joe Hill penned as well,
too. And for people that don't know, Joe Hill is the son of Stephen King.
Yes, he is. He has a horror novella called Black Phone that Scott Derrickson, who did Sinister and Doctor Strange, he's going to be returning with his writing partner, Robert Cargill, and they're going to be adapting this movie called Black Phone. And so I looked up the synopsis of Black Phone, because I haven't read the book. And it says, John Finney is locked in a basement that's stained with the blood of half a dozen other murdered children. In the cellar with him is an antique telephone, long since disconnected, but which rings at night with calls from the dead. Okay, I'm in. That should be
fun. Sounds good to me. Yeah.
Did you see that study? Speaking of Scott Derrickson, did you see that scientific study that scientifically proved that Sinister is the scariest movie?
I did see that, yes.
I thought that, and you know what? Like, I saw the headline, like, science proves the scariest movie, and I thought it was going to end up being like The Exorcist or The Shining or something. And I clicked on the link, and when I saw it was Sinister, I sort of went, okay, like, I mean, I'm mad about it. I think we all sort of we all are on the Sinister bandwagon. And Kevin, we did that junket, and I remember just being like legit terrified.
I have never seen it.
You've never seen Sinister?
No, I have it here, and it's not open. It's sealed.
Dude, it is
one of the best horror movies of all time. I don't think I'm overstepping.
I would argue The Shining is the scariest movie ever made. I would put Sinister probably at 2.
What is it about? Give me the one-sentence log line.
I mean, the story, it's like a story you've seen a million times from the basic idea of it, Jake, right? So a family moves into a house. Ethan Hawke is the father. He finds a box of old 8mm films, and they're all labeled in a very disturbingly clever way of how a murder went down. And that particular element of him watching the 8mm
film. Family barbecue.
Oh, God. The Shining to this day still is the scariest movie I've ever seen. Sinister is right there.
No
Sinister
kidding.
Is genuinely, it is so, and I think what happened with Sinister, I don't know if this happened with Jake, it was so unassumingly scary. I had absolutely no idea what I was getting myself into. I was like, I'm going to see an R-rated movie. It's a horror film. It's Scott Derrickson. Seems like a haunted house type deal. But the atmosphere of it and the sound of design and the way it's performed and Ethan Hawke and the children, it's just very
the ending.
It is hands down one of the most disturbing and scariest films I've ever seen. And I highly recommend. I actually Jake and I don't disagree with that article in a weird way, because I would probably give it to Shining, but I don't disagree that Sinister is one of the scariest, if not the scariest movie I've ever seen.
You remember what else was on the list? Did you look?
I didn't look.
I remember Hereditary was on there.
Yeah. For anyone who hasn't seen it, just to explain what they mean by scientifically proven, they basically monitored heart rate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, did they really? Article.
Yeah.
But I thought you had read it. Yeah, they have. It's kind of cool the way that they monitored people's heart rate as they were watching the movie.
See, have you seen
what
it?
The
Gabe?
Biggest spike was Sinister.
Yeah.
No, I haven't seen Sinister actually.
Which is why I would think that like Shining wouldn't necessarily be on, because like Shining is more of a slow burn, and so you know your heart rate is not racing while you watch.
It's a good headline.
Sean,
yeah, of course. Scary.
You gotta watch Sinister and report back.
Okay. Yeah. Well, soon I gotta watch Fat Man. Like tonight. So that's on my list.
We all have to watch Fat Man.
But I have Sinister here. I love whenever we talk about something that I haven't seen, and it's a title that has been like on my radar. And then I look over to my shelf, and there it is. It's sitting right there. That's
Jake Lawnmower.
All right. Stop. He's just teasing things that I don't even know what they are.
We're just going to say words.
I just said lawnmower, and Jake said barbecue.
Cleaner.
Yeah.
All right, let's get to
family
so this
barbecue.
Is an unusual award season in the fact that we're starting to now see some titles that theoretically are going to be contending. Within this past week alone, most of us caught up with Mank. We were able to see Hillbilly Elegy. And we are getting information about Regina King's film One Night in Miami, and something interesting that broke about its Oscar campaigns. We're going to be having this conversation a lot with these films, because we can also talk about Trial of the Chicago 7 and where actors are going to fall in their categories. So for One Night in Miami, for people who aren't familiar, it takes place, as the title indicates, following a Cassius Clay boxing fight, and he gets together with three of his closest friends who were extremely influential at the time: Malcolm X, NFL star Jim Brown, and acclaimed musician Sam Cooke. And it's one of those ones where I think everybody gets the same amount of screen time, but they're going to break up this way when they go into the awards race. Kingsley Ben-Adir, who plays Malcolm X, and Eli Gorey, who plays Cassius Clay, are going to go into the leading category, into the best actor category. Aldous Hodge, who plays Jim Brown, and Leslie Odom Jr., who plays Sam Cooke, the singer, are going into supporting. This is apparently how Netflix is strategy. Wait, it's not Netflix. One Night Miami
Amazon.
Might be
Amazon.
Amazon Prime. Okay. This is how they think that they have their best shot. This is a really tough one because all four men are fantastic. And if anything, they might steal focus away from each other. And so now you have two people who are stealing focus away from each other in one category and two people who are going to steal focus away from each other in the other category. When you guys get a chance to see it, I think you'll be as hard pressed as I am to determine honestly who's the lead. I can see why they're going with Malcolm X and Cassius Clay. They do get the story's somewhat told through their eyes, but Jim Brown and Sam Cooke are just as influential in the movie. It's based on a stage play. I was unfamiliar with that. It plays like a stage play. It's got a ton of really long dialogue. It's primarily driven by conversation as these four men decide to they discuss how much impact they should be having in society and culture at this time, whether it's okay for someone like Jim Brown or Sam Cooke to just be content that they've succeeded at the athletic level or as a musician, or whether they should be taking that influence and putting it to use the way Malcolm X does, the way Cassius Clay decides he wants to start to put his boxing legacy.
So he's not Muhammad Ali yet.
Not yet. No.
Interesting.
He's contemplating going into the Nation of Islam and changing his name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali. So fascinating, really fascinating. And I can't wait to see how the rest of the season plays out, because especially with something like Hillbilly, you would have someone like Amy Adams. Now, Jake,
mm-hmm.
She gets about as much screen time as Glenn Close in that movie, does she not?
Yeah, you're not wrong, but I still feel like if I'm Netflix, I put Amy Adams in lead and Glenn Close in supporting. Just because the character of the grandmother feels like a secondary character.
For sure.
And the mother, you know, and the Amy Adams role is kind of the character that kind of gets the wheels. Like, she is the character by which, like, the plot revolves.
Yes. Gabe, you said something? Or had something?
Oh, I was just going to ask if you think Regina King has the shot of getting nominated for it.
Yes, absolutely.
You think she shows up in it as far as a director?
Yes, awesome. Absolutely she does.
I am down for a world in which Regina King exists in every award show moving forward.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care what, like,
she has. Yeah. She has an acting Emmy and an acting Oscar, right? She's won both.
Well, she won the Oscar for sure. What'd she win the Emmy for? Watchmen. Oh, yeah, you're right. Watchmen. So she needs a Tony and a Grammy.
A Grammy. Give
but
it
even
time.
If she gets an acting Oscar, an acting Emmy, and a directing Oscar.
Yeah.
That's bad.
Wait, she
in a very short amount of time.
A very short amount.
Oh, she won for Barry Jenkins' film, right?
Beale Street?
Yeah.
She just won for Beale Street. God, she was so good in that. Yeah, she's incredibly talented.
She makes it look easy.
Is that a Christmas Day release? I think it's a Christmas Day release.
It's definitely December.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway.
They should give her an Oscar for Watchmen, even though it's television. That performance is so amazing. God.
Yeah. No, she's unbelievable.
If you haven't seen Watchmen, I know Jake was on that a long time ago, but man, that is.
I'm glad you dug it.
That is like some of the best media I've ever seen. Yeah. It's so good.
You know, the showrunner of that created another show that was equally fantastic.
Is it this right here?
That's the one. You know who that's scored by, actually? Michael Cicchino.
Oh.
Yes. The whole show is scored by him. All six seasons of it. Jake, you watched the chess show? The Queen's Gambit?
Queen's Gambit,
Is that good? I've heard really good things.
Yes.
Is it really?
Oh, my God. Yes.
All right. Yes. I think Michelle and I are going to start watching it.
And it's only seven episodes.
Oh, nice. Very cool. Okay, cool. We're going to dive into that.
Did it bring you a lot of Anya Taylor-Joy?
You know, maybe just because the world's burning right now.
You're going to let that go?
I kind of missed them. I feel like we haven't done them. I feel like we haven't done them for a while. It's true. I'm in a weird place. I'm tired and I'm exhausted. And I missed them, dude.
I'm in a weird place.
I'm in a weird place.
Kevin, can you please tell us about the Man of Steel prequel?
Ma Kent.
Remember, we got both of them at the junket together, didn't we?
We did.
That was a good room.
Yeah, this was a surprisingly good movie. I didn't know anything about it. So, full disclosure, I watched it because I did the junket for it, and I didn't really know what to expect. And, you know, I love Kevin Costner, but
Is terrible. The title is so generic.
It's such a bad title. I actually keep forgetting if it's Let Him Go or Let Go of Him. I keep forgetting what the title is. But the concept is essentially... you know, Costner and Lane, their son is married. They have a child. Their son ends up dying in a horse accident. The widow of his son remarries into this like very strange family. They then take the grandchild with them away from Costner and Lane without any say or what they're doing. So Costner and Lane go after them, essentially, is the basic premise of the movie. So, you know, they're diving into a strange family dynamic, a dangerous family dynamic. The actress, and I'm going to blank on her name, but please help me here. She was in Phantom Thread. She is so good in this movie. She plays like the grandmother.
She played his sister in Phantom
Thread? Yes.
Leslie Manville.
Leslie Manville.
Yeah.
Unrecognizable. Really? So much so that I couldn't remember her name. But so good. So for people who haven't seen the film, this is in the trailer as well, but you'll see her. She plays the grandmother of the family that takes their grandchild away, essentially. And she's a villain in the film. And the way she's introduced in the movie, the lighting of her introduction shot is amazing. Giacchino scored the film. I thought Costner and Lane were amazing. What I loved about it is Diane Lane really is the lead. And I like that she's the one pulling Costner with her. You know, and it kind of like goes into this idea of, you know, I'm married. I think my wife really runs everything. I don't know about you, Sean, in regards to that, but I feel like that the movie kind of shows a great dynamic of how incredible a marriage can be, and especially in this particular case where Diane Lane is such a strong, incredible force. And I love that character was so awesome. Like, her character is so badass, and I think, you know, in this regard, in this particular case, Costner's kind of along for the ride, and Diane Lane's kind of the one pushing it, and I thought that was really kind of a cool thing to see in cinema. And I think they're great together. I think Diane Lane, you know, I always go back to Unfaithful. That's like probably one of the greatest like thrillers.
She got an Oscar nomination for that.
So good in that movie. And it's interesting because they were married in Man of Steel, so they get to work on their, they get to kind of further a marriage idea in Let Him Go.
Is the baby's name Kal-El?
It is. Yeah. Well, no, it's Clark Kent. They didn't go the Kal-El angle. They wanted to keep it a little easier. No, but it's very hard not to think about it. They're on a farm. There's horses. I mean, were there horses on the farm of Man of Steel? I don't remember now.
I don't think so. There was corn,
whatever it was. But it was still a farm.
The poster looks like if you color graded it a little bit differently, it would look like a Man of Steel poster.
Yeah. I just think Diane Lane's a really great actor, and I think that she's a little underrated, and I think it's really cool to see a character like that in
Here's
cinema.
A question.
She's so great. Yeah.
Here's a question. Is Kevin Costner underrated as an actor?
100%.
I think he is.
100%.
I think he's really good.
I think people forget how good Costner, because Costner hasn't had a hit so when was the last time Costner led a hit?
But for a long time, he was enormous.
Right. That's what I'm saying. But like, okay, so you go back when Costner was crushing it, right? So Dance with Wolves, JFK, Bodyguard. Yeah. He owned the 90s. Costner was a huge, right? But
I think is it because his style is so subdued? Like,
yeah,
if they were ever to you know, do the Cecil B. DeMille for him, he always kind of surrounds himself with people who have like the bigger scenes than he does. He's kind of like the calming sort of voice of reason.
And that's the case here. And that's the case here. Like, Diane Lane is the badass in this movie. And Costner is kind of the supporting character, even though he's a lead, technically speaking. It's interesting. I walked away thinking of Diane Lane and not Costner in this one. But they're both great. It's an interesting question. Yeah, well, Costner, well, it's like the other day when I posed that question about Rob Reiner. Like, there's a lot of, there's a lot of people who've done such great work that we actually forget are great. In the sense of, like, Rob Reiner has so many classics on his list, but he's never talked about in great director discussions. And it's funny because you could say Rob Reiner and Coppola had a similar up and then a down. Now, Coppola had classics like The Godfather and Conversation and Apocalypse Now.
Rob Reiner
now,
also has classics.
So did Rob Reiner. But Coppola is still discussed today in that regard, in talks about great directors. Reiner fell off. So it's like Costner.
I would say Reiner's comedies are just as important to comedy as Coppola's dramas are to drama.
You're talking about The Godfather and Apocalypse Now.
That's not what he said. No, Gabe said
his comedies for comedy's sake. Like Princess Bride, like I think in the realm of comedy. Mm-hmm.
I get what you're
saying.
Those are
monumental for me at least.
When Harry Met Sally, like when Harry Met Sally and
he did Spinal Tap.
I think that's controversial. I think that's controversial.
No, in the realm of comedy, you don't think that if someone came to you,
I know what you're saying. Yeah. No, I understand.
Came to you and said Harry Met Sally.
Versus Godfather.
No, it's not the comparison. They're saying that like when Harry Met Sally is like the Godfather of comedy.
It's like
maybe you don't agree with that, but you don't have enough to go against it.
It's like Halloween is the Godfather of horror films.
I agree with that.
When Harry Met Sally,
I'd give you Carpenter in horror. I think that that's a fair comparison, but I don't think I'd give you Reiner in comedy.
What in Reiner's filmography? So you wouldn't consider When Harry Met Sally a classic?
No, I'm not saying that. But we're talking about one of the greatest dramas of all time in The Godfather, and one of the greatest war films of all time in Apocalypse Now.
Okay.
So you got to tell me that Rob Reiner made one of the greatest comedies of all time. Maybe Spinal Tap could be argued about.
No,
for me, The Princess Bride is up there. Okay. But that's me personally.
Not that it's comedy,
Misery?
But like this is the dude, A Few Good Men.
Yes, I'm not debating that.
A Few
that.
Good
I
Men
think
is one of your favorite movies ever made.
Right, but it's not a comedy. We're talking about his comedies.
Okay.
You don't think When Harry Met Sally is one of the greatest comedies of all time?
No. No.
Who hurt you?
Yeah.
No, no one did. I think it's perfectly fine. I'm not saying it's the godfather of comedies.
All right, Sean, on that shirt. Your opinion's just going down the
drain.
No,
first of all,
I will say Spinal Tap, you could argue. Spinal Tap might be what The Godfather is.
No, it's not.
The legacy of comedy. But when Harry Met Sally? No.
Spinal Tap is too niche. Spinal Tap is like almost like Rocky Horror status, where it's a fun movie that's like fun to hang out with. I love that movie, don't get me wrong. I think what Gabe is saying is that he's not saying that When Harry Met Sally is the godfather of comedy. He's saying it's too. When Harry Met Sally to comedy is what Godfather is like a drama.
I understand the comparison.
But you love A Few Good Men, so let me ask this. What if we rephrase it like, what if we said A Few, I guess, how would you use
A Few,
the
good,
few good,
men
good Men
is the godfather of courtroom dramas.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. Of courtroom dramas. Yes.
We're getting
A Few
real.
Good Men is one of the...
we're getting real niche here.
Starring Tom Cruise.
But it's an interesting discussion, but we've also had a discussion on the show before, too. I thought Brad Pitt was underrated. As an actor,
I think Tom Cruise is underrated.
As an actor, as actors,
yes.
If you want to sort of underrate them as actors,
yeah.
But Kevin Costner is absolutely one of those guys who. So we were on the Jack Ryan set visit, the Shadow Boxer. What was what was that one called? With Chris Pine, and
wasn't it just called Jack Ryan?
I thought it had something else after.
The second just called Jack
colon
Reach Further. Or I don't know what it was.
Anyway,
with Chris Pine.
With Chris Pine,
I think it's just called Jack Ryan.
Chris Pine was in Jack Ryan?
He was Jack Ryan. Kenneth Branagh directed it, and Kevin Costner was his boss in it.
What? What movie is this? Yeah. Why have I never heard of this? Wait. Hold on a second.
I'm sure you've seen it and probably did the junket for it.
Captain Kirk was Jack Ryan.
Wait a second.
Keira Knightley was his wife.
Yeah.
What's the name of the movie with Tom Cruise that Macquarie did?
The Jack Reacher.
Jack Reacher.
Oh, I'm such an idiot. I'm thinking of the Amazon show.
Yeah.
Oh,
that Krasinski
Jack Ryan is what is Tom Harrison Ford played him. Ben Affleck played him. Alec Baldwin played him.
Okay.
Shadow Recruit.
Chris Pine. Yes. Chris Pine was Jack Ryan in Jack Ryan : Shadow Recruit.
Shadow Recruit. There you go. Yeah.
When did that come out?
2014.
I've never heard of this film.
That's the problem.
I bet you did the junket. I'm telling you.
Probably did. I have no idea.
So we were
I remember the poster because I was working at Blockbuster? Yeah, I was working at Blockbuster at the time, and I remember the cover is just Chris Pine in like a black t-shirt walking. It's the most indiscriminate, like, I guess I'm going to watch that movie.
We were on the set for that. They were shooting in London somewhere, and we were literally the only thing they were shooting on set that day was Chris Pine running up a flight of stairs. And Kenneth Branagh had him doing it like a dozen times with a bunch of setups in between. So it took forever. It was the entire day. And periodically people would come over and we would get Kenneth Branagh for a couple minutes. Then we got Chris Pine for a couple minutes. And Kevin Never Costner came down. And Costner sat down. We were in a round table. There's about 10 of us there. And he starts talking to us about getting involved in the Jack Ryan franchise. And he talked about how he almost got the Harrison Ford part. You know, he was up for Hunt for Red October. No. Which one was Harrison Ford? Patriot Games? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. He was up for Hunt for Red October. And he instead, I think, did, I think that's when he did Dance with Wolves. It would have been around that time.
Oh, wow.
1990 was Dance with Wolves. So, yeah.
And he decided he wanted to invest in himself and direct his own picture.
Can I play ignorant movie fan for a second here? Sure. Jack Ryan. Oh. So that whole universe is interesting to me. Like, where else? So that's all the In the Line of Fire. Like, that's all within Okay, what's different?
That's just Wolfgang Peterson.
No, but isn't there a connection with all those movies that, like,
you're thinking of Patriot Games?
Patriot Games.
And Clear and Present Danger.
Yeah.
What's the connection?
Are the Jack Ryan ones.
Okay. Well,
they were adaptations of Jack
Ryan. In the Line of Fire is
Tom Clancy movies.
Isn't In the Line of Fire? Is that Clint Eastwood and John Malkovich?
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
I, for some reason, thought that was part of that universe.
They made a bunch of those movies. Back in the
all kind of 90s and
2000s. Yes, similar stuff to that. So anyway, Costner sits down with us and he gives us 20 minutes and it sort of evolved into a talking about his career type thing. And he was just regaling us with stories from all the things that he's done. And the publicist comes over and taps him on the shoulder and he turns around and looks at her and he said, "I'm not supposed to be on set today. And I came down here specifically because you asked me to talk to these guys. So I'm going to sit here and talk to these guys, if that's okay." And the publicist was like, "Sure." And he stayed for an hour.
Wow.
And just told the stories.
Well, that's a guy that you could talk to for an hour.
100%. Because it got to the point where you just forgot all the things he was in.
Yeah.
And he would casually mention, like, "Oh, this reminded me about that time when I was on set with Sean Connery in The Untouchables." And then we were all like, "Oh, I got 5 Untouchables questions. Let's go.
Did you talk Field of Dreams at all?
Yes, we talked everything, literally everything. But it was what I was getting to is that, and this goes to his underrated bit. That was one of the times when that man just exuded charisma, like big screen charisma. And you were like, just in conversation, and you were like, "Oh, that's why you're a movie star. I totally get it." Like, I couldn't stop listening to him. Everything he told us, we were all like on the edge of our seats, just like, "Tell us more, Kevin Costner." And I, so totally reminded me of
it's interesting when you see, you know, because it doesn't always happen, and I feel like it happens so infrequently that it's worth calling out, like you just did, when you see people with that natural charisma. And, and Kevin, you know, even like you, like we you and I have both met presidents before. And you see that and not to bring that up today, but you see that in presidents where you see them working a room and you just go, "Damn, like that's why you're a like, cause you got it, man." I was in a room with Clinton. I've been in a room with George W. And you see him walk in the room and you just go, "Son of a bitch." Like that is some charm you got there, man.
Yeah,
I believe it.
I agree with you.
All right. The other movie opening this week, in addition to Let Him Go, is Possessor, a horror film that I've heard people talking about. It's on VOD. I know
it's a hell of a poster.
Earlier. What is it? What's it?
So it's a kind of it's yellow and the person's face is like all disformed and disfigured. And that's the extent of my knowledge.
Dude,
of the film.
What it's, was the I'm sorry. Okay.
No, sorry. It's Cronenberg's son, right?
Yeah. Oh, right. That's right. Yes.
A lot of people's sons in this episode.
What was the feedback from your Halloween piece?
Oh, Daenerys loved.
Daenerys, let Daddy talk.
No, it was great. It seemed like people really did. My favorite feedback is that whenever we aired it in chunks on my morning show, Good Day Chicago, is that people called in and complained that it was too scary. So I took that as a massive compliment. But, you know, honestly, the people who... I wanted to enjoy it, which is you guys and people who really sort of love those movies. And then I got a lot of positive feedback from the actors themselves that were featured in the piece. It was very positive. I think I'm just so wiped from working on it that I think whenever I was done, I was just sort of like, Like, to the point where, like, even by the time it finally aired, because I was done with it and it didn't air for, like, I think, like, another 2 weeks. Like, I think I was just going, like, oh, like, I'm just, because you guys
it
know.
Took
like,
so
I, you
much
know,
time.
I,
it took a lot of time.
Yeah, I was talking about it for a month, and then it took me a month to get all the actors together, and then it took me a month to edit it. So, well, thank you for asking. But, yeah, I think I just kind of forgot about it.
It had an impact on me because I watched, and I don't think I texted you about this, but I watched Halloween the other night, and my favorite shot in that film besides the opening is the tilt. And I actually, I didn't know this, I didn't know the story until I watched Jake's piece about the actor, like, because Carpenter just told him to do that, right? Like, he was like admiring his kill.
Basically,
I just, always just found that to be the scariest part of that movie for some reason,
right?
Because it was like this guy admiring his murder,
dude. Yeah. And Vince Vaughn does it in Freaky, and we forgot to ask him about it.
I had that down in my notes,
and he does it early on. Yes, he does it pretty early on, and I figured it was a Carpenter nod, and I wanted to ask him about
That's interesting. Damn.
Dan, get him back on the phone. Can you, Gabe, can you get him?
I'm talking to him Monday.
Ask him.
Oh, you should ask him.
All right. Well, I mean, it's, but I didn't notice it. So, I mean, I feel like that would be...
So,
all right. I'll say my friends from Real Blend noticed this. All right, I'll bring it up.
Okay. However way you want
to
do it. All
right, we'll find out if it's a nod to Halloween. We'll get the answer.
That's a great question. And based on our interview with him, he's clearly... like a film aficionado, I think you'll appreciate that question.
It's well, so deliberate.
I'll just say, like, I was talking to the Real Blend guys who were on our show, and we were I'm wondering if this was a nod to, literally a nod.
Phrase it like this. Hey, Vince, why did you rip off Carpenter? Isn't that hacky?
Yeah.
And then
I mean, you already ripped off Hitchcock. Might as well just keep going.
Zing!
Hey!
All right. We are recording this before episode 2 of The Mandalorian drops, so we're going to give really quick reactions to how season 2 is going so far. I got roasted a bit because at the end of the episode, I didn't quite notice.
How did you not know?
Wait, do we need to say we're
going into spoilers?
Let me settle this for one second.
Yes, we're going to. Yeah. So hold on. Yes, let's say that.
Let's give your general thoughts and then we'll do a quick spoiler bit.
Okay.
But we'll let people know before we start.
One thing I will say, and I have no problem saying this, Sean, I am 100% with you.
I had absolutely
no idea. Until Jake texted me, but we'll get into it. You're not alone. I did not recognize the character at
I did
all.
Hear that from a lot of other people. So I thought it was great. I thought
Best
it was
episode
a really
of the
great,
show.
Yeah. But I'll say this, though. The show does have and you leveled this criticism at it, and I can't argue with it. It does have a mission of the week type formula to it, which is okay, because I think that the missions are actually pretty exciting. And the practical effects to bring this creature that they have to fight, which there's a lot of lore, mythology and lore in the Star Wars universe that gets pulled into this dragon, apparently, is a really prominent thing to the point
where...
We saw it within
the first 5 minutes of A New Hope.
Oh, for real?
When C-3PO and R2-D2... crash down at a Tatooine and they're walking in the desert, they walk by that long skeleton of a Krayt dragon.
No kidding.
And as a kid, I've always wondered, like, what the fuck is that thing?
Really?
Like,
no kidding.
Yeah, that's why I was like, when the Krayt dragon shows up, I was like, holy shit, we're actually going to get to see one. Like, we've seen a skeleton for 50 years and now we're finally actually going to be able to see the real. Oh, it was fantastic.
Just to give some clarification. So for people, because I had to relook this up too. This takes place between Return of the Jedi and Force Awakens.
Seven years after Return of the Jedi.
So I guess my point is some of this going to bleed into Force Awakens? Are we anywhere near Force Awakens time period? Or are we like stuck in the middle of these two?
I think stuck in the middle. I think they can tell several seasons of Mandalorian before they ever caught up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because think how much older the main characters are from Return of the Jedi until Force Awakens.
No, I know that. I was just thinking about... Jake, I have a question since you're the Star Wars person. I'll be honest with you. Yes. Huh. See, well, it's funny because when they went to Tatooine at the beginning of the episode and we were dealing with the sand characters, and I was like, okay, there's obviously connections here, no question. And forgive my ignorance on this, but why do they in the Mandalorian episode? And again, Jake is the Star Wars aficionado. I'm a casual fan of Star Wars.
You're
but they mentioned two Death Stars being blown up in Mandalorian 2. The reason I got confused at first was because obviously the first Death Star blows up in you know, the original trilogy. Then we had the Star Killer base in Force Awakens, which was basically a Death Star. What's the second Death Star?
No, so there's a second Death Star in Return of the Jedi.
Return of the Jedi. That's right. That's right. Okay. Yeah. All right. So that's what makes, that makes sense then. Because I was confused at first because Star Killer base. That's what I was thinking about.
All I didn't pick up until I watched the episode a second time that the ship, the tiny ship that Timothy Oliphant is driving, is one half of Kid Anakin's ship from Phantom Menace. So that stuff is just unbelievably cool. Like, Filoni and Jon Favreau are so immersed in that culture. And I think that for diehard, true diehard Star Wars fans, those are the things you tune into each week. But in addition, just the characters are cool. Mandalorian's cool. Baby Yoda's a cool character. I think bringing in Oliphant is a really interesting way to go.
The Oliphant thing was awesome. Wait, did we know he was going to be in Boba Fett's costume?
And again, that's another thing too. When you first met him in that cantina, when he came in, it was dark and shaded in a way that I just thought he was wearing traditional Mandalorian armor. Yeah. I didn't notice it was Boba Fett's until he came out of the thing into the sun. Same. And then I thought, oh, all right, well, look at that. But then I got lambasted from other people who were yelling at me about that too, saying it was absolutely Boba Fett.
So. But Sean, I mean, at the end of the day, like, you and I are Star Wars fans, but we're casual fans. Jake is obviously more of the, has seen them way more than us, I would argue. So I didn't even pick up on the ending specifically. And I'm with you. I don't think there's anything wrong with admitting that. I mean, we're all nerds and movie nerds, but at the end of the day, if you don't recognize something, just be honest about it. I did not recognize that person until Jake mentioned who it was.
I didn't. So, I don't think Jake did either. I think he's lying. you're muted. Your dog hit your mute button. Jake is now holding Daenerys if you're not watching the YouTube
version.
Well,
because there are window washers outside and she's very upset.
All right, let's get to beyond who is that. Let's get to one of the most famous people featured in a blend game on the history of Real Blend, true Hollywood royalty, Jack Nicholson. And we are playing hashtag Jack Nicholson Blend. Kevin, I'm going to throw it to you first. Tell us your favorite Jack Nicholson film.
I mean, this is such a hard one, but my favorite Nicholson film, I mean, clearly if you're going best, I would go Shining. My favorite Nicholson movie is As Good As It Gets. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's a film about OCD. Mm-hmm. And there's an OCD element to it. I was diagnosed with OCD when I was 14. A lot of the way OCD is portrayed in cinema and media is a little bit kind of like a watered down version of it, the germs element of it and things like that. I mean, I've been dealing with OCD all my life, so I've gone through the germs phases and all those different things. I don't necessarily think As Good As It Gets is the greatest portrayal of OCD ever, but it was comforting to watch a major film that dealt with a character who's dealing with, I mean, I remember, what was the show, Monk? His character dealt with OCD. And I know OCD has been in cinema. There was just something about comforting about seeing it in a comedy. Mm-hmm. But also, I just remember, I love Greg Kinnear. I love the dog in that film. The dog in that film was always the reference of a dog that I would, because our last dog, Oscar, was a Brussels Griffin Shih Tzu mix. Oh, yeah. And anytime someone would ask me what kind of dog Oscar was, I would say, do you remember the dog from As Good As It Gets? That was always my reference point. So I think As Good As It Gets, I choose it because of what it means to me overall. I also think Nicholson is absolutely fantastic in it. It's a comedy. It's interesting to me because generally speaking, comedy doesn't get the love and respect it deserves. But when you throw someone like Nicholson into a comedy and he's dealing with, he's flowing through drama and comedy masterfully. And then the whole Greg Kinnear angle, Helen Hunt, I mean, it is just a wonderful film. And I think that Nicholson, as much as I love him in The Shining and obviously a lot of the work he's done in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where he's brilliant, those are films that I have a hard time returning to over and over. For me, there's a comfort in watching Nicholson in a film like As Good As It Gets. That's also the Nicholson I know and remember always. Mm-hmm. I mean, like the Nicholson from The Shining and Cuckoo's Nest and all those movies, it's a different Nicholson than I grew up with. I kind of grew up with that 90s Nicholson look. So to me, that's like his immortalized role and look for me will always be Nicholson. I mean, it's so funny because like I'm contemplating in my mind why I didn't go with The Departed, but I just find it. I think it's not Departed's brilliant, and he's great in it.
Not bad, Sean.
But I think it's a great movie. I don't know what you're talking about. But As Good As It Gets is going to be my pick, solely because it just means a lot to me. I don't think it is a great I don't think it's like a accurate, brilliant representation of OCD, but it plays with the ideas of it in a major motion picture. A major actor is dealing with it, and I found it interesting how he handled it, comedically, dramatically. I think Greg Kinnear, did Kinnear get an Oscar nomination for that film? He is so good in that movie.
Yeah, Helen Hunt won.
Yeah, so Helen Hunt won for that, and so did Nicholson. Did they get a picture nomination?
Yeah, like they lost to Titanic.
Wasn't that the last year, one of the last years that got picture director and the three act or three big acting categories?
It didn't. Oh, you mean to be nominated?
Nominated.
I thought American Hustle would have.
Oh, did it? Okay. I thought it set some kind of a record in terms of like the number of.
It may have, but American Hustle. And also, that was the Titanic year. So I think it was just those two Oscars, and I think that was it.
Gotcha.
Can I mention just an honorable mention because it wouldn't even have like cracked my top five, but I just wanted to bring up Anger Management because I kind of like that film. And I've only
seen it one time when it came out. I've seen it since.
I just like Nicholson's dynamic with Sandler. I don't think it's like a great film by any means. I just find it comforting and fun. I don't know why I like Nicholson in comedies, but I think he does a good job. What was it, The Bucket List with Morgan Freeman they did together?
I like The Bucket List.
Me too. And I think, As Good As It Gets is probably the one I would pop into my mind first. And to be honest with you, I'll be fully honest, I did not have my pick until I just said it.
There you go. Jake, so, what'd you go with?
Yeah,
I'm going with The Shining. Just his performance. Yeah. One, it's my favorite horror movie. But his devolving into a monster, his personification of alcoholism, as we've learned, you know, represented with Stephen King. Can you remember a monster who is so charming? Like he is a guy who is genuinely to a point where he is possessed and trying to chop up his family with an axe. And I am just sitting there and I cannot take my eyes off of him. I mean, his performance, like it's, and you know, Kevin, you use this, this sort of train of thought a lot, but it's such also a heartbreaking performance that every time I watch it, I think that like, part of me is like, come on, like snap out of it, man. Like same. But there's a part of you that hopes that he can, because, you know, especially too, Dr. Sleep also gave me such a greater appreciation for The Shining and for Nicholson's performance. There's that moment where it flash forwards in time, and I think Danny's getting like his 8-year chip at AA, and he says something about how like my dad wanted nothing more than to be here at this moment. Mm-hmm. My dad wanted nothing more than to be here for his family. And that makes Nicholson's performance even more heartbreaking because he wanted so badly to get away from alcoholism. He wanted so badly to get a fresh start. That he was like, that's what that hotel was supposed to represent. You know, it was supposed to represent a chance to bring his family out there, get started on his new novel, get away from the booze. And the fact that what ended up happened is all the more heartbreaking. And I just thought that he perfectly represents it. He is a man who can represent someone who's broken and down on his luck, but also someone who you're cheering for to get better. And then obviously the man knows how to represent a monster. It was a easy pick for me.
And to me, there's nothing more powerful than what Jake was saying about a film where you hope something happens differently. Mm-hmm. Like every time I watch Terminator 2, I genuinely hope that he won't sink himself into the molten steel.
Movies work.
But it's so funny. It's like Titanic. It's the
unless they're George Lucas movie.
Yeah. yeah. Greedo shot first. Han shot first. Who cares? No, but I find it interesting what films do that for us. Not every movie does that. There's only certain ones. And I think
Back to the Future with the lightning strike.
That's a great one.
There's like Titanic is one that happens for me on like I say to myself, just get on the board or like maybe this time you will or like
is
you
it
know.
Is it usually movies that we kind of watched growing up where like because I feel like as a child, you're much more open to the idea of maybe things will work out differently in a movie.
Yeah,
like, I don't
really
find myself doing it as much as an adult unless it's a movie that I watched as a kid.
But and that's kind of the speaks to the brilliance of what Quentin Tarantino did with like Hollywood, for example, where like it's it, you do get the magic.
Like what if
you
what,
do
what,
get
what
that.
If it, yeah. Yeah.
And it's like it's very that to me is very interesting thematically as a filmmaker. If you dive down that path where like you are getting a change.
Damn
like,
it. Now I got to watch Hollywood again.
Dude, I put it on the other day for I think the 21st time. Just like it's a background film now for me.
I put it on a lot during the summer. It's a great summer, like you know, like there are summer drinks. Yeah. I feel like that's a great summer background movie. Just like when the sun's up and it's warm outside, pop it on, have it in the background.
That'd be a cool blend game, by the way. I don't know what we would call it, but like second chance blend or whatever it would be like. A movie ending that you always hope will change when you watch it. I don't know. I don't know if that's too confusing to dive into, but could be something interesting.
Yeah.
An idea there. So people might assume that my choice for Jack Nicholson blend would be A Few Good Men. A movie that I raved about often, but I don't feel that that is a Nicholson film. I feel that that's a Tom Cruise film. So I went with the other Jack Nicholson film, which I could honestly watch daily, which is Chinatown.
I love when we have three different picks.
Especially with Nicholson, his filmography is so deep.
Insane.
Obviously, I've talked about my love for...
His name's Jake.
Detective films, very specifically those 40s, 50s, 60s era gumshoe type films. But as I was falling in love with that genre and picking up a bunch of different examples of them, I tapped into what he did as Jake Gittes in Chinatown, and it just became the seminal example of... He thinks he's the smartest guy in the room. More often than times, he's not. He figures out that he's working his way through the case, but comes up with a bunch of clues by accident a lot of times.
Yeah.
There are huge reveals and gut punches coming in Chinatown that I will not give you away here. And he is just as gut punched by them as they arrive.
Physically.
Oh my God. Yes. And he's just phenomenal. I mean, he exudes charisma. Young Nicholson is like staring at a bright, shining star that you can't tear your eyes away from. Obviously, working with Roman Polanski, who was firing on all cylinders at that point as well, too. It's probably the best screenplay that's ever been made. It's studied up and down. Robert Towns' screenplay is studied in classes for the way
that's
that
a good
it's
blend
to.
Game.
Screenplay. That's another really good one.
And it's just a great screenplay.
I'm in love with California and that era of California.
Yeah.
It's everything about Chinatown is fantastic, and specifically Nicholson, and specifically the way that he plays it. So
and they make water interesting.
Yeah. I was thinking of water when I think of Chinatown. Yeah.
Chinatown is so brilliant, and I was interviewing someone the other day, Jack Huston, whose grandfather is.
John Huston.
Yeah.
It's John Huston.
And John Huston's in that scene with the knife, right?
Yes.
So Polanski.
John Huston is the grandfather in that one. I don't think it's John Huston who cuts him.
Well, no. Polanski is the one who cuts him. Right. I know that. Polanski plays the guy who cuts him, correct? If I'm not mistaken, I believe Polanski that's his cameo. But I think Huston's in that scene too. I think, but maybe I could be wrong.
I'd have to go back and see. So John Huston is the older guy who he goes to on the Orange Groves, who he interviews. But I forget if he's in that scene with the nose
I'm
cut.
Almost certain. Someone double check this. I think Polanski's the one who actually cuts his nose.
Yeah.
And I'm almost certain on that. It's so funny because I rewatched my father-in-law is so awesome. And his birthday's coming up. So happy birthday, by the way, Damien. We watched Chinatown a month or so ago at his house. And I did not know Polanski was the one who cut his nose. I did not know that.
It is Polanski. Yes. I'm watching the scene right now.
But Houston's in this somewhere in that. And I just can't remember. I don't know why that came to me, but yeah. Anyways.
Anywho.
Great movie. Yes. But Houston's in the movie for sure. I just don't remember if that's the scene or not.
He is not in the scene where he cuts the nose. Houston, he goes and interviews him later at a different time.
Okay. Cool.
And I don't want to reveal his importance to the story in case, God forbid, you've made it this far into the show and haven't watched Chinatown. Okay, Marquise Martinez says, as good as it gets. And Kevin, they write, it's the film that showed me Jack Nicholson could play somebody other than a crazy maniac. And him as a vulnerable man with OCD being swept off his feet by a waitress was so enjoyable to watch, and he's amazing in it. Randy Buss went with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And Lydia Mascaro went with somebody who I was guaranteed one of you two would choose, which is Joker. His Joker from Batman.
But he's, I think my issue is that he's Jack Nicholson.
He is.
It's Jack Nicholson fighting Batman. You know what?
Doesn't that sound awesome?
That does sound awesome. You know what? I love him, man, and he's only in it for just a couple of minutes. Broadcast news.
Yeah, true.
He's like the network anchor.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, he's great, Matt.
Small part though.
It's so funny. I actually don't. When I think of Batman, I don't think of Nicholson really.
No, but it was a gigantic part for him.
But what's funny, I would argue that the opposite happened in Dark Knight. Ledger was the
keep in mind Nicholson got top billing over Keaton for Batman, and Nicholson, go back and look at the Batman poster. It says Nicholson on the top.
Keaton was only like Mr. Mom at that point, right? Like he didn't have huge roles to his name, I don't think.
Yeah, I actually, that's really interesting. I can't believe Nicholson got top billing.
Yeah,
that would be like, yeah, that's weird.
So for next week's episode, of course, we have to play hashtag Sean Connery blend. So come up with your favorite Sean Connery film and we will pay tribute to the legend who we just recently lost. So no review this week. A reminder to drop us a review on iTunes. Gabe, you wanted to punch in and add something to the conversation at this point. Now you are muted, so I'm not quite sure what you're saying, but
yes, I did want to punch in.
Hi.
And just to say, if you've sent a review and you haven't read it, we recently, in the back end of changing a bunch of stuff, and so something may have fallen through the cracks. Feel free to resend it to us, realblend@cinemablend.com.
Our next premium episode, if you guys are premium people about it, subscribers to the premium episode, we are going to be debating the 1997 Oscars. We're going to be re-reviewing the winners from the 1997 Oscars.
Well, the 98 Oscars, right?
For the 97 movies, right.
97
right.
Movies, 98 Oscars. Right.
Thank you. Yes. And so get
which
your
is confusing, by the way.
It always throws me off.
Yes.
As for next week, we're going to be back with another very fun guest. And we mentioned in the show what movie it's going to be related to. So go back and pay attention to what we mentioned. It has something to do with the movie that
we're getting Kubrick for The Shining.
We're getting Jack Nicholson is going to come out of retirement and join us on Real Blend.
For two hours. So
follow us at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell. Follow the show at
Real Blend. I do have to tell you to that joke before we wrap up. Whenever I was like sending out mass emails for that monster piece, I did reach out to Nicholson's people to see if he would talk to me about the show.
That's funny.
Do you ever get an email back and you can just like, you can see the person's face in their response? I could just see like the public just going like, Jake. And they were very nice and they're basically like, you know, and because I even sent the email like, hey, I'm not expecting, you know, and basically
is it someone
like,
that
yeah.
you work with or no? A publicist you work with?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. That's a leg in the door.
Did you reply back?
Which is why I think, no,
did you reply?
I didn't.
You should have replied back and say, but he's on my bucket list.
And then I guess I'll say, I guess this is as good as it gets.
This is as good as it gets. All right.
No, there were a few good men left, yeah. All right,
Pubie!
October's over. We can't use that.
No, please, stop. That is not going to be. We are not.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.